Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I'm sure that we've all experienced that unique thing that happens when we sit down to write something, a letter to a congressman, a short story, for some a novel, that moment when words actually begin to be put down. It seems a new channel of thought opens up that has wisdom and ways of expression we don't have when we just talk about things. So we're going to take a break and then do a reading from a new writer. So just stay tuned. In the weeks and months ahead, I'm going to be doing a series of readings. I think it'd be fun, primarily by current living writers about nature and the environment. Whether they're published or not doesn't really matter. What I'm looking for is great content, great written word from people who capture their thoughts and ideas while way off in the backcountry or living an urban existence with thoughts of the wild or flying into the middle of a harp seal slaughter and putting their lives between club and cub. There's a special message that flows from the written word, and it's important that it be heard. So, do keep in mind that following the reading, I'll be telling you how you can get your writings featured on the Wild Side News. So, today I'm going to be reading a segment from a book by Susan Chernak McElroy, entitled All My Relations, and published by New World Library. So please enjoy River Elk. It was to be the most glorious of summers. All my prayers for the right place, the right work, the right time converged the day I signed the lease for the river house. I had just sold my home, the home that had burned to cinders and that I had rebuilt over the course of a year. My divorce was finalized, my new book partly done. I had a new sweetheart, Fritz, and my passion for life was flowing like the snowmelt that had just begun running down the Tetons. The house itself was modest, a 50s vintage cabin with little character that had seen better years. I referred to it as cozy, but in truth, it was tiny and cramped, with bedrooms that must have been designed before the creation of queen-sized beds. The back porch had partially caved in. The kitchen stove was home to several generations of mice, and the gravel driveway was a maze of teeth-rattling potholes and ruts that turned into lakes and rivers after a moderate rain. But the front window faced the Grand Tetons, and the kitchen and back looked out over a meandering trout stream that flowed between high cottonwoods and willows. Between the cabin and the mountains was nothing but the Snake River, flowing in undulating channels and carving out an ancient strand of river bottom. The setting was as close to paradise on earth as anything I have ever seen before or since. That the cabin was there at all, and that it was available to us, was a miracle. I imagine you could count the small, history-laden cabins that remained along the Snake River in Jackson Hole on one hand. Our neighbors were all millionaires and billionaires, their houses not houses at all, but huge estates with grand names and entry gates made of massive logs, iron or stone. We never met any of them. Next door to us, an 8,500-square-foot log and rock estate with its own man-made stream that you actually could switch on and off was under construction. The builders of this estate property controlled the general lease on our tiny cabin, which sat just out of sight behind a stand of spruce and cottonwoods, and they were wanting to rent it out for at least 6 months. I signed the lease papers on the 1st of April, near giddy with joy. And the very next day we began moving boxes into the place we christened the River House. The porches were still sagging under the weight of old winter snow, and the trees around the place were ashen-colored and bare. The Snake River on our front door was at low trickle, receiving just a fraction of the snowmelt that would be in full cascade by May. Through the gray and spindly mishmash of cottonwood twigs and willow bushes, our other new neighbors slipped past us in full and stunning view as we unpacked box after box, eagles, owls, deer and elk, moose, two brown bears, muskrats and beavers, porcupines, coyotes, delicate-legged cranes, geese by the hundreds, and endless flocks of returning songbirds. I filled up a half dozen bird feeders twice a day to keep up with the throngs of chickadees and grosbeaks, nuthatches and flickers, hummingbirds and titmice. A family of 7 baby chipmunks moved into the woodpile just outside our back door and stuffed the pockets of their cheeks with sunflower seeds scattered by the birds. God was blessing me, I told myself, for all the hard inner work I had done reconciling myself to the house fire of the previous year. How generous all the spirits were to bring me to this magnificent place in which to complete my book and begin my new life with my new love. I moved to the cabin, humble and grateful, knowing that it was a sign of affirmation that I had done a good job and was on Creator's spiritual A-list. For the rest of the summer, it just got better. The trees budded, and goslings and otters floated by on the swollen river, which called to us day and night with a voice like strong, fresh wind. Cranes did their mating dances, wings outstretched and toes pointed, leaping into the blue mountain air. A baby boot-nosed bull moose nibbled on willow branches outside my office window, so close I could hear the leaves being pulled from the stems while I wrote at my small desk for hours and days that seemed endless, timeless. The feathers that came to me on my river walks each day with the dogs were tantalizing. I found the fluffy breast feathers of ravens and owls, the tail feather of a bald eagle, the crisp wing feathers of geese and hawks and ducks. Our front porch became a tangle of driftwood and old bones. For each of the gifts I brought home from the abundant river, I gave thanks and left a gift in return, strands of my hair, a flower, a spontaneous song, a prayer. And then on the 23rd of August, on a warm night that held just the tiniest hint of fall, my grand and affirmative summer became completely perfect. In the still of the late night, under a canopy of summer stars, a bull elk trumpeted outside our bedroom window. His voice started low in the chest, rumbling up his neck in a hollow bellow that morphed into a high and breathy flute whistle as it left his lips. The sound of the rut, the seeding of new life, is a sound I seek out every fall, but this was the first time the sound ever came to find me. Always before, it had been me stealing quietly into the forest in hopes of finding the bulls, listening on the edge of night meadows for the sound that brings shivers up my spine and into my face and squeezes hot tears out of my eyes. This night, the elk came to me, singing a circle around the river house, bellowing his love song until the black sky blended into dawn pearl. For all the symphony of sounds I had heard that summer, nothing touched the magic of his music. As the night sky faded, I heard his hoofs crunch in the dry cottonwood leaves and fade into the morning toward the river. In the ensuing moments of pre-dawn silence, I imagined he had come to me as a culmination of all the signs of affirmation I had received that summer. All were gathered to him, held by him, wrapped in the gift wrap of his voice and tied in ribbons of his presence. When he returned near dawn the next day to serenade me again, I bolted from my bed to catch a glimpse of him. In the gray light, I saw him walking away from me, once more toward the river. His crown of antlers was fat as my arm at the base, held high on a neck thick and dark as a tree trunk, and no doubt as strong. He stepped high and deliberately, and his outstretched nose was humped and broad. How beautifully, how perfectly he suited his voice. In the weeks to come, two more bull elk came to the river, one with a lyrical call of all flute notes and no chest bellows, and one a square-bodied, stout fellow whose call was always discordant and off-key. In the night, we would hear the trio of bulls dueling for the herds of cow elk that were gathering all around us. At first, the bugles would sound far from one another, then closer as the bulls marched forward to fight for the right to claim the cows. on still nights, when the air carried the sound from the river up to the sky, we would hear the clack of their antlers crashing against one another, the sound of bone to bone. During the daylight hours, mostly in the morning and at twilight, we would sometimes catch precious glimpses of the elk, both cows and bulls hurrying along the dry river channels, anxious and excited with the energy of rut and breeding. Soon we realized that the off-key bull and the lyrical fluting bull had lost the battle for the cows. The harems were in the custody of our bull, the deep-voiced, massive-crowned singer. It could be no other way. The fluting bull was smaller, younger. The off-key bull lacked that throaty resonance that signifies a huge-necked, mature, confident bull elk. The cows had chosen well. On an evening walk I will never forget, we turned a bend on the river bank and caught a view that lodged my breath in my heart. It was September, twilight hushing the sounds of the day. In front of my eyes, a peninsula of sand and grasses jutted out into the season-spent river. Gathered on that white sand, standing quietly among clumps of green bushes and yellow grass, 24 cow elk grazed under a sinking sun that splashed golden light across their backs. Between us and the cows marched the bull, our bull, strutting back and forth, nodding his antlers from side to side, stretching out his neck and face to shoulder level, and bellowing his song. His back, too, was lit with the golden light that poured from the autumn sky like honey. The whole world before me seemed to be wrapped in a circle of precious amber, and peace rose up from my heart and lodged in my throat. I wished instantly and fervently for that sight to never leave me, and it never has. I wrapped my arms around Fritz and sighed into his chest that life could get no better than this. The next day, as though in direct response to my claim of perfection, our landlord called to deliver the news. The big estate next door was completed and sold, and the new owner had other plans for our little cabin. We had 30 days to move. 30 days to pack up, to find a place that would rent to us with 2 dogs and a cat, and to put the river house behind us. Both of us were struck speechless and dumb. Normally, I go into high gear at times like this. My middle name is Can Do. But this time, I collapsed inside and out and could do nothing. My feet felt weighted with river rocks, and I walked through the next week of shining autumn glory as though I were wading through mud. Fritz collected boxes, but I could not feel them. I could not lift up my hands in any effort that would take me away from my home on the river. They hung in clenched, hopeless fists from my arms and would not serve me. At night, while I huddled under my covers, exhausted, miserable, and sick, the river elk, our elk, would call hauntingly from the woods by the water, and I would weep and wonder how I could possibly leave him. On Sunday morning, 2 weeks after our landlord had told us we needed to move on, Fritz and I finished up an early oatmeal breakfast and headed out from the front door on a straight line toward the river. The air was clear and citrus-flavored, and the dogs were leaping like gazelles. I was in a bubble of misery that even the river could not burst. And so I did not notice at first that the cottonwood tree in front of me was draped with 100 ravens. I did not notice the magpies whirling over me or my dogs as they shifted from dancing to stillness. These things pierced me only when Fritz said, "Can you smell it? Can you smell it?" Like a waft of black smoke, the scent enveloped us, thick, sweet, rank. Real time became dream time, and we moved forward silently, like puppets on God's strings, pulled against our wills to the edge of a sandy bank that dropped off to the river bottom. Above us, the ravens hunched silent and wary. Below us, just over the edge of the low bank, lay a tangle of massive branches. No, not branches. Oh, God. Antlers. Sprawled in front of us, his neck twisted harshly, his huge rack of horns impaled point first into the dirt, lay the river elk, dead. The four of us froze in silence. In slow motion, the dogs approached him, crouching and extending their noses to touch his golden back. Arrow whined and licked him softly. I slid down the bank and dropped to my knees beside him and extended my hands, my leaden hands that had stopped serving me, to touch his neck. It was still warm. Sounds fell from our mouths as Fritz placed his hands on the white tips of the elk's antlers, but no words came to us. In those first moments of shock and denial, all we could do was murmur, sigh, gasp, and moan. When we could finally speak, we told ourselves that he must have been fatally gored in a battle with one of the other bulls. We touched him everywhere, from his glassy, dull eyes to the curve of his sable-colored thigh. There was not a mark on him. He was sleek, fat, shiny, massive. Urine soaked his saggy mane, and I felt its stickiness on my hands. That rancid anointment had been a signal of his pride and his power, the cologne of the breeding bull, the intoxication of his cows. The birds loomed above us, impatient and suspicious. Now my legs and hands moved freely. My mind cleared. What to do? First pray, then open him up for the birds. Fritz headed back to the cabin to fetch an axe and my ceremonial pipe and some sage. I sat in tears, rocking and stroking the velvet nose of this one whose voice had carried me on a magic carpet of sound through the most picture-perfect summer in my life. I could not leave him, I told myself, and so he had left me. His body was bent in a wrenched and awkward pose. It looked as though he had fallen off the shallow embankment head first and never moved again. Instinct commanded my hands, as it had years before, when I prepared and tended the body of my father for the coming of the hearse. I grabbed the bull's feet and tugged, trying to roll him onto his side so that I could ease his antlers from the dirt and lay him out in a figure of repose. His deadness resisted me, hundreds of pounds of non-responsive flesh and bone, but gravity was on my side. He finally turned and settled so that his neck and his trunk were facing the same way. That was when I found the small, bloodless hole up near his back. Why I did what I did next, I do not know. My hands reached for the wound, and then into it, fingers coming up into his body, while my mind said, "How deep? How deep does a gore wound go?" I felt the splinter of a bone against my hand and automatically wrapped my fingers around it and pulled. My hand rose up in front of my face, holding not a bone, but the broken shaft and razored point of a metal arrow. Blood dripped from its hollow core. My eyes widened in horror. It was not the world that had taken him away from me, but a poacher on these private lands. Someone had watched for this bull, for these antlers, for this head. I shivered and looked into the trees around us. Surely he was there. Surely he had stalked our elk as he stumbled his way through the trees to collapse and die directly in front of our cabin. I looked at Strongheart lying quietly, watchfully, a few feet away. My devoted and fearless guardian, Strongheart, would defend me and defend this spot against anyone. I would not give up the river elk. When Fritz returned, we smudged the body of the elk with sage and tied prayer ties to his ankles. We gathered dried flowers and foxtails into a bundle. I loaded and offered my pipe, sending prayers for the river elk's soul journey and gratitude for his voice and his magic. With axe and butcher knife, we split open his hide so that the birds could carry his spirit with them. And then, in the end, we severed his head, that prized and regal head that had cost him his life, and dragged it back to the cabin with us. That afternoon, with Strongheart in tow, I hurried back once more to the elk's body. carrying an old elk skull I had found along the river. I placed it at the elk's neck and then stepped back, taking a long cleansing breath. The river elk lay with his skull head grinning, his feet sprouting the colors of the prayer wrappings, a bouquet of dying wild flowers and grasses over his heart. He was a spirit being now, and I stood still in wonderment at the look of him. It was not yet time to leave. I sat down near the bank and asked myself questions, deluding myself into thinking I knew the answers. My first question was, why? Several answers came to me. He did this for me. I'm not good enough. It's a sign. God has dropped you from her A-list. I have failed the test of this summer. Then, what was the test? Something is over. A new beginning is coming. Have you not felt it in the cold night winds of these weeks? You and your new love are crumbling, and your partnership will not last. Because I did not know what else to do, I rose to leave. Take me with you, I heard. I looked at the elk. I did take you with me, I told him. Your head is in my car. I'll clean it down to bone and keep it safe always. I'll honor your spirit. Take me with you. My body jolted up in sudden recognition. I knew exactly what I was being asked to do. Communion. I don't know if I can do this. I'll be sick. In slow motion, my hands sweating cold, I crouched down by the river elk's gaping neck wound and tore off a small chunk of meat. Gagging, I put it in my mouth and swallowed hard. It tasted horrid, metallic, gritty, greasy. My throat muscles constricted around the flesh and tried to send it back up. I swallowed again, gagged again, and then it was done. Calling Strongheart to me, I turned away from the elk and hurried back to the cabin. It was finished. The summer, the elk, all of it. That night, my no longer uncooperative hands wrapped themselves around me like a comforting shawl, and in the morning, I began to pack. I've been reading from a segment from a book by Susan Chernak McElroy and published by New World Library. It was called River Elk. Now, if you're a writer, published or otherwise, and would like to have your writings featured on the Wild Side News, I'm looking for a message from you. Here's what you can do. Send me an email. Send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. With information about you, about your piece, include your name, email, and whatever you wish to share about yourself. Now, my preference is that you attach the writings as a Word document to your email, or, of course, you can just embed it in the text of the email, but I'd prefer an attachment. Please include a sentence stating that you authorize me to read this on the show, and I'll confirm with you if your piece is selected to be read on air so that you can make the most of it. You can enjoy it yourself, and you can let all your friends know that your writings are being featured here on the Wild Side News. So I want to say thanks. I'm looking forward to this new feature. And now, in just a moment, we'll continue with some great new outdoor ideas that you just may find interesting when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
River's on the rise, swift and gentle like the breeze. It swallows everything but sky. It suffocates the trees. Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? And does it even matter? If I sink or swim.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.